with Common Ground. And what we've been doing is for quite a number of years is hosting a series of conferences in areas like, for example, sustainability. But one of the areas that we've focused on, inspired to a large degree by Amar's work, in fact, is this idea of an inclusive museum. So to give you a little bit of a sense of the format and what we do, of course, this COVID pandemic has forced us all to be purely virtual. But in years past, we've had an annual conference, and we have quite a wonderful journal where papers that have been presented, both plenary papers and parallel sessions, have been published. We've got many hundreds of papers that have been published over the years, building up this body of knowledge about the work of museums, a very valuable body of knowledge, and also a series of books. And Amar's played a wonderful role as the kind of editor-in-chief, curator, host of this conference over all those years. So welcome to everybody. We're now in this COVID situation, which is a very contradictory, unexpected set of events that's affected museums quite profoundly. It's affected conferences quite profoundly, which is why we're purely online. And I think one of the interesting lessons which we might be exploring through the conference is the extent to which some of these changes, even when things go back to normal, what's normal, will be lasting. And I know with our conference, for example, we're planning on building what we call a blended model, where in future every session will have a recorded video component, and we will have people able to participate virtually all the way through the conference, even when we're able to meet in person. And we're building a whole video discussion infrastructure at the moment, which will support that. So anyhow, welcome everybody. And what I'm going to do now is hand over to Professor Galar, my friend Amar. I can address him in all those ways, who is going to be the person who coordinates this plenary session.
Thank you, Bill. For all of you who are listening from across the world, we usually have about 500 registrations for such plenary sessions. There might be about 150 people, I think, that have logged in, but others listen to the recording afterwards. And now I know that Bill hasn't introduced himself really, but Professor Dr. Bill Cope is the founder of Common Ground Research Networks. And he's been a comrade and a colleague on the long journey to a range of knowledge communities with several of us across the world, and with us in particular with the Inclusive Museum Knowledge Community. Bill, we really appreciate your leadership, your generosity in supporting this Inclusive Museum Knowledge Community. And also with us is Tamsin Gilbert. Tamsin is a conference producer for the 13th International Conference on the Inclusive Museum. And this is the plenary session. And the plenary session focusing on the theme, urban futures and historical urban landscapes. But to discuss this, we have a wonderful set of panelists, and you've all got the confirmation email with the outline of what this is all about. We consider urbanism as a process, it's a dynamic process. So you have someone like Joanna Souza Monteiro, who is the director of the Museum of Lisbon, dealing with the deep layers of heritage in Lisbon and Portugal, as well as Europe in general, in communicating, what does it mean during the pandemic, in the post-pandemic situation to run a city museum, if you will. But she's also the president of the CAMOC Committee of International Council of Museums, that is the International Committee for the Collections and Activities of the Museums of Cities. Now you can imagine that when we have a large number of people living in the cities around the world, the role that city museums play, and how do we understand the contextuality of these city museums in terms of the urban landscapes. And then we have Dr. Mario Moutinho. Mario is actually one of these dream faculty members that we all want to have. He's an architect, he's an anthropologist, So there are not many people who are anthropologists of the built environment in the world. And he's one of the rare experts in this area. He's the rector and architect and senior researcher at the Lusophone University of Humanities and Technologies in Lisbon. Then from my own institution, we have Associate Professor Dr. Ashima Sood, Anant National University. She has a PhD in economics from Cornell University. Ashima, every session, like one of the things that Common Ground Research Networks does is, you know, bring in the next generation. You know, in fact, we have a lot of young people who chair, who host, who moderate. So here too in the plenary, Ashima is our youth voice. And she's a passionate advocate for urbanism as a process, but takes a particular approach based on the economic valuing, you know, of urbanism. But first, to kickstart the panel, we have Professor Dr. Uta Portkis here, who I was privileged to meet when I was a keynote speaker at her institution last year at the end of October. Well, she was the one who invited me. Thank you, Uta. She's with the Department of Architectural Engineering, remember Architectural Engineering and Technology, Delft University of Technology, Delft TU, one of the top three, you know, design universities in the world and in the Netherlands. So each of the panelists will speak for about, you know, 8 minutes to addressing up to 3 points on the theme that you all got in the confirmation email. And then we're going to take questions. So please, you know, there are protocols in the chat room. So read the protocols, please respect the protocols. And the second thing is that if you have any questions, please post them in the questions and answers box that is there. I have Sharvari who is going to collate them, flick them across to me, and I'm going to put them across to the panel. So that's the procedure. And I'm not going to do detailed introductions anymore. I just call on the people. I myself, I'm a Salzburg Global Fellow. I'm the chair of the Common Ground Research Network on the Inclusive Museum, and also editor of the journal, as Professor Bill Cope mentioned. And I'm at the Anand National University. And it's a pleasure and an honor to welcome you all from around the world. I think we have about 86 countries represented. That's wonderful. And especially we get excellent participation from Africa. It means a lot to me having worked in Africa. So now we'll kickstart on the theme with Professor Dr. Uta Portkis here. Uta, over to you.
Let me unmute myself. Yes, it has worked. Dear Amar, dear Bill, thank you so much for this introduction. And I have to say that I am very excited. It's the first time for me to speak in let's say, in this community. And I'm amazed of that, how many participants from all over the world. I had a short look to the chat are participating. So Amar generously introduced me with a double engineering, and it's right. I'm placed as a chair of heritage and technology within the Department of Architectural Engineering and Technology at TU Delft. But together with my colleagues Anna Pereira Rodas and Wessel de Jonge, we are representing the section of heritage and architecture. Which is a little bit interesting, but which fits probably very nicely to also to this session. We are a kind of interdisciplinary team. So the crossover in between architects and engineers is something that has always been to my interest. And I did my PhD myself in a civil engineering factory back in Germany after studying architecture. That's for your knowledge. And I was teaching an interior architect now for more than 15 years. So I think that is important to mention that we have to learn to think cross-disciplinary, and it is important to experience different disciplines by yourself to get a kind of understanding of maybe different characters, of different methods that are to be applied. But let me come to the theme of today's conference. It's about historic urban landscapes and urbanism as a process, and also the role that museums may play in that. My talk will focus on one aspect, and which will be modernity. And that has to do with my, let's say, second role or third role that I have. I'm also representing DocuMomo. As you may know, it's a global organization also with more than 73 chapters worldwide, actually hosted in Lisbon at the moment. That's a coincidence. We have two speakers from Lisbon. So DocuMomo stands for Conservation Documentation of the Modern Movement. And I'm vice chair of DocuMomo Germany, and I'm also sharing the Committee of Technology within DocuMomo International. And coming back to the conference that Amar just mentioned, which was our kind of kickoff conference last year at TU Delft, which was on heritage and the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. In our closing keynote, Randall Mason from Philadelphia put something a little bit provocative when he said, "Modernity creates problem, and it categorizes, it puts everything into boxes, and it is not really aiming at a holistic approach." Of course, this was a provocation. Looking back to the historic urban landscapes of the 20th century and of those of the beginning 21st centuries, which is already 20 years now, where we have also seen rapid and dramatic developments. So let's put this and as a kind of starting point for the three points I'm going to address. Modernity creates problems. I think maybe the biggest problem is the speed that we are confronted with the last 120 years compared to the historic urban landscapes that have developed before, and that challenges us in understanding and in rather predicting and not having time to look back. What DocuMomo does is, of course, looking back. And when it started in 1980 and the 1980s in the Netherlands, the colleagues did exactly that. They looked back to the beginning of the 20th century and tried to understand what was driving the urban and social processes. And they discovered that actually architects at that point were very much concerned with societal questions, with health and well-being of the citizens by creating a new part or a new kind of social housing, but in general improvements in housing situations. And after this organization developed with the 73 chapters that there are worldwide now, there is a notion of that this kind of modernity is perceived very differently in each continent, maybe in each country. And today we are speaking about multiple modernities, and that is a term that I would like to stress. We cannot work with one definition, and there is of course always this kind of complaint or concern that this view of modernity is a European, a Eurocentric approach. So what I would like to address is really to, for you who are active, to reach out to understand what is the modernity of your city, of your place, of your country or of your continent, of your region. And probably there, for sure, there is not one answer to this. And it was just mentioned in the introduction today, what is normal? We can looking to Corona and the pandemic, and somehow we are all expecting that this may change our behavior, our look to the world. But I think we have to live with a diversity, which is very challenging. So, defining modernity and multiple modernities, which means also to define different historic urban landscapes. That would be my first lesson or point to mention. Then, coming back to the introduction of saying about modernity has started to categorize everything, to break it down in little pieces, and we forgot maybe about the holistic approach about looking at different categories and balancing things, because that might be a kind of modern scientific approach which always forces us to be very precise and to look into little details. And what I would like to address is that we understand and that we learn and find and define methods to come back to this holistic approach. And that is something that really keeps us busy and is one of our ambitions in Delft, to collaborate, first of us, the three of us, together with our colleagues in the Department of Engineering and in Urbanism and in Architecture, to make these cross links, to create feasible, and that's important, feasible and maybe simple methods that can support this holistic approach for the diverse modernities and concepts of historic urban landscape. And this means also, if I talk about multiple modernities, that probably this is not just one method and not one approach, but that we have to accept that there might be different methods and approaches. And this is often critically seen within the scientific approaches where we hope to have validated methods which often also forms a kind of clash of the disciplines when it comes to engineers that often follow a very systematic and quantitative approach. And on the other hand, when we talk about social scientists that rather follow a qualitative approach. So this is my speech to encourage you to follow this combination of different methods by looking at multiple modernities, exploring multiple modernities, and to come up with a holistic approach which somehow is incorporated into the idea of historic urban landscapes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Portgis here. Thank you, Uta. Very much appreciated. Multiple modernities. Modernity has fragmented us, but how do we come back to a holistic, you know, approach? How does Joanna, as the director of Museum of Lisbon, deal with modernity? I mean, she's got fantastic collections. I've been to that museum some time ago, and she has amazing programs. But in terms of the experience, she brings people together. Joanna, over to you.
Thank you so much, Amar. So first, I would like to thank you, Professor Amar Gala. It is a very, very nice to be in such a promising webinar, and it's a pleasure to work with the Inclusive Museum Organization. We will host next year the physical conference of the Inclusive Museum, also with the Universidad Lusófona partnership with the Professor Mario Moutinho. So thank you for this opportunity. I would like to address very briefly so the three points. First, it would be about what city museums are nowadays, because they are transforming into something very different from the last 50 years or so. And then I would like to explain how, Professor Amar just addressed, how our Museum of Lisbon is trying to respond to the outbreak pandemic. And the third will be what is very briefly our ICOM community, International Committee of International City Museums, and what are we doing right now? Just one or two ideas that we at least, yes, we and I also consider more relevant now. So what about city museums? Along with the idea and the reality of cities themselves that are of course changing very, very rapidly. And as everybody knows, cities are concentrating the majority of the world population, which is something that has very, very serious consequences in all senses, positives and not so positives, and places very, very important challenges for everyday life. And along with this process, not only the megalopolis, but the urban change in general, cities, museums are responding to it. And so there is a movement of change in city museums. First, let me speak about the change of old city museums, like our Museum of Lisbon, and there are older city museums, mainly across Europe and North America, and also some in South America. They are, for the last 20 years or so, they are transforming themselves a lot, changing even their mission statements, but also the collections they are gathering into more contemporary items and not only concerned with the past history. They are changing their permanent exhibitions and changing the way the story, the past history of their cities is told, embracing transversal issues that are, of course, at the daily life of any museum or at a lot of museums in the world regarding decolonization, social rights, equality, and migration movements, and of course many and sustainability amongst other transversal themes. But in our case, in the City Museum's case, we are also very much concerned make the story told, not stop in the 50 years ago or even 100 years ago, and make the story come to the today's life, because as the cities are changing so rapidly, the museums, of course, we cannot just take pictures every day to what's happening every day in cities, but we should be more and more aware of what's happening in changing also the cultures of the city and the languages of the cities and the food of the cities and every way the life is happening in cities. And so museums are embracing new themes, new ways to exhibit, and new topics to be exhibited that have to be to do with everyday life, and also act more and more relevant, in a more and more relevant way to the city residents, including migrants, of course, regardless of nationalities and origins, geographical origins. And maybe, at least in our case, we're not so much concerned with tourists, and they're more concerned with the diversity of the residents. Whilst there are many, many city museums in the world, fewer in Africa, but they are growing, but lots of them in Asia and North and South America, and also New Zealand and Australia, and of course in Europe, across the whole Europe, are changing. There are also lots of them being created from scratch as new museums. So we have city museums that are created that are more close to urban study centers, and so more close to architects and urban specialists, and other there are more like apparently traditional museums with collections and research and documentation and everything, but also embracing and enhancing research on very relevant topics for today's life in cities. The second topic would be about our Museum of Lisbon. Our museum is very old, but it opened in our main venue in the late 70s. And we are, like so many others in the world, changing, transforming completely the permanent exhibition and the way the story of, which is a very, very long story, because Lisbon as a city has 2000 years, but we are changing the way the story is being told. And we are especially very active in making temporary exhibitions about both historic and traditional themes, more related to the communication of our very important collections of tiles, archaeology, historical painting, and so forth. But also very concerned about researching and exhibiting themes like the light of Lisbon, the history of the city from the pavements perspective, many consequences about the urban growth in the urbanism itself, and many others. One of our concerns right now is about sustainability, and we are working on one very big research project for 3 years, almost four now. We are opening next month an exhibition about the history and the present age of the vegetable gardens in Lisbon since the Middle Age up to today or even tomorrow's age of vegetable gardens, relating food security, of course, urban sustainability, relation between the nature growth and the growth of the urban constructions, and how people, nature, and the constructions can live together, can better live together. And we are also addressing very much directly in this project and exhibition and book some important stories of immigrants that work, that live and work in Lisbon for many different reasons, and that growth very different vegetables, which create very different cultures in our daily life. About the COVID-19 outbreak, the museum, like of course, well, plenty of other museums across the world, we tried to enhance our digital being. And within a week after the emergency state was declared and we had to close the museum, which was something very cruel to do, we were able to create and deliver every single day different digital contents on Facebook and also Instagram, and some of them on our YouTube channel. And we created specific contents trying to connect in an empathic way our collections. And we started with a very simple tour made in our storages, our central storages, connecting our life of inner life with the inner life of the people that had to be stuck at home with this very big problem. And we started to create videos and narrations of images of our collections, and also learning contents specifically addressing the families that were at home. And so for 4 months, the 2 months of the emergency state and the first 2 months of the slow open up again to the to the public, we had over 400,000 views of digital contents, which for us was very interesting to get. And we are trying to learn from that results and stay as relevant in the digital context as offline content. And after that, in late July, we opened an exhibition called Still Lisbon, this is the brochure of it, that resulted from asking for photojournalists for their photos of a very totally or almost totally empty city. And the city is a big city with lots of people, and like in all over the world, suddenly it became with a part of its soul just gone, because no one was there. And so we had a very, very quick, but very, very nice and fruitful work with this photojournalist and the curator. And this exhibition is really interesting to lots of people that are, some of them seeing a very beautiful city, because it's not visually polluted with cars and transportations and people, but also for many, maybe to the majority of people, it's a very like a solidarity distress, feeling of distress between people who are living there and feeling the impact of the sudden emptiness, and those who photographed it and displayed it with some poetic, we think, inland. And finally, my third point, it's about CAMOC. CAMOC is one of the 30 international committees of ICOM, which is the International Council of Museums. We have now about 600 members across the five continents. And our members are mainly professional people working in city museums, but also urban experts and architects and people that study and work with urban sustainability. We have online and all at your disposal, 7 books and 11 issues of our review, which growth from the previous newsletter, and we still have there also online 22 issues of the newsletter. There is plenty of food for thought in these publications, online publications, all digital and free to download. The committee tries to do reflect upon the growing focus worldwide on cities, about their economic importance, the spectacular growth, and the problems and possibilities that spectacular growth present. The matters of debate regarding cities are almost endless, since, well, pollution, regeneration, urban regeneration, cars and public transportation, the suburbs, the destruction of heritage, and all kinds of challenges coming from the migration movements. We had a special project for over 3 years only about migration and cities, which was really, really interesting for all of us. We are setting up an online a webinar on the 7th of October, only focused on the response for the COVID response from city museums and cities themselves. We are now working on working on city museums concepts and definitions, reworking on it, gathering ideas, and we are starting a international partnership with partners from Taiwan, the Netherlands, and Asia Pacific, South Africa, and Argentina, among other places. A project that will hopefully in 3 years end up on delivering a book and an online group of contents regarding the mapping in the world of city museums nowadays, which
thank you, Joanna.
We don't have yet. Thank you.
That's fantastic. Thank you. I mean, it's bringing museums, making them relevant in the urban landscapes across the world. And there are many members of CAMOC that are listening to, so welcome to CAMOC members. Thank you. Now, we move on to Mario, Rector Mario. Mario is an architect and anthropologist. You know, we started off with an engineer and architect, and now we move on to Mario. Mario, you advocate, you're one of the pioneers in dealing with socio-missiology. Could we hand over to you now to reflect? Yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you, Amar, for the possibility you gave me to share some ideas, I believe, and a lot of doubts that I have when we talk about these trends of museology. Well, I prepared something written because I don't want to go more than my 8 minutes. So let me read and it will be better. Well, I believe this webinar takes place in times of insecurity, but also improve enrichment. Times of insecurity, as no one knows what our life will be in the coming weeks, months, or even years. Times of impoverishment in an economic system centered on the accumulation of health and the so consequent exclusion of most of the world population. Times of xenophobia, racism, obscurantism enter the parliaments of so many countries. And in cities sometimes anger and revolt take up the streets. But this is the time we live on. And it will be the understanding of our world that will make us face the social issues. And if the recognition of the impoverishment is necessary for us to live in our time, it is also necessary to give meaning to the place that we intend to occupy as citizens in our relationships, in our jobs, in our universities, in our museums. Let us share how Alma Witlin in the post-World War II described his idea of museums. She said, museums are man-made institutions in the service of men. They are not ends in themselves. What can museums do with regard to the unmet needs of people? And I will repeat often this idea, unmet needs of people. Museums are not islands in space, she said. They have to be considered in the context of the life outside their walls. When Alma Witlin talks about the unmet needs of people, she is actually pointing out that the place of museums will be to look to present daily challenge. It took years for the social dimension of museology to be recognized. There were years of affirmation of innovative, sensible, militant museology. But nowadays, this process have a growing global expression. They highlight the social responsibility of museums as a factor of development. This new reality has had a significant impact on the academic and professional environment, revealing itself in the increase of national and international scientific meetings, as well as the increase of underground, master, and doctoral higher education in many countries, and the consequent production of dissertation, theses, postdoctorates as a result of a more consistent scientific research. These museums that deal with the unmet needs of people more and more have an expression in the so-called social museology, and particularly in what we can want to call insurgent museology. This museum's approach was recognized in the final document of the MINOM ICOM, affiliated organization to ICOM, which took place in Rio in 2013 in defense of a museology aiming to understand the understanding of community museums as a political, poetical, and pedagogical process in permanent construction and linked to the very specific worldviews, and recognizing that the organization give and take, these organizations give and take, make and unmake their memories, feelings, ideas, dreams, fears, and live their own reality without asking permission to establish authorities. But the rationality of this change in museology did not occur alone within museology itself. On the contrary, they express profound change that have occurred in the field of social science as a whole. In the last decades, particularly relevant since the 80s, the social science have been facing profound transformations. We are thinking about the emergence of the public dimension of sociology, anthropology, history, the public dimension of philosophy, among others. After a long period of struggle for recognition within the social science, these public schools of thought are now recognized for the contribution they have made, a theoretical approach, and as a strategy for to find solutions. In result of the same process, we can say that museology with social responsibility has been recognized as part of social sciences and assumed as a public museology known as school of thought, which today we can call socio-museology. And this socio-museology, making appeal to the broadest interdisciplinarity, we can say holistic view, as I've been proposed in the beginning of this webinar, seeks exactly to contribute to the clarification of the concepts generated in the innovative museological practice. Practice assuming social museology, community museology, indigenous and native museology, LGBTQI plus museology, eco-museology, critical museology, among others. In all cases, a community dimension is present. The recognition of the primacy of dialogical processes are present too. The involvement with social, environment, and sustainable issues are also present. In other words, we live a time where the unmet needs of people mentioned by Alma Witlin as well as the proposals highlighted by the Roundtable of Santiago, or more recently by UNESCO recommendations in 2015, become tools for the museums. In consequence, sociomuseology is not a new term for the new museology. It should be instead understood as a public museology based in a systemic interdisciplinarity with other areas of knowledge doing and thinking the new trends of museology as a resource for sustainable development of mankind. The starting point for sociomuseology seems to be rather distant in time, but if we consider its epistemological roots, it is impossible to sustain sociomuseology without also reclaiming the same resources and the same reference as other public social sciences. This is most evident when we have to support and reference Paul Freire, Frantz Fanon, Gramsci, Habermas, for example. In other cases, it is also hard to think sociomuseology without Marx, Weber, Durkheim, whose contributions continue to support more consistent understanding of contemporary society. It is hard to not consider the thinking of a host of researchers and museologists who have contributed in particular since the 70s to the knowledge in the fields of museology in general, such as Georges-Henri Rivière, Per Aune Green, Hugues de Varine, Stransky, Gregorova, Peter van Mensch, Martha Jones, Sharon McDonald, Sofka, Mário Chagas, Cristina Bruno, Bernardo Loche, Richard Sandwell, Pierre Meyrin, just to name a few. For us, sociomuseology represents the possibility of looking at the complex reality of museums with social responsibility in its diversity of concepts and priorities, but also trying to understand their relationship with other museums' concepts, priorities that are the result of other political and social contexts. For us, and I'm going to finish, sociomuseology also represents the possibility of understanding new rationalities, of building new professional and academic curricula for our universities, new partnerships for a more respectful world and cognitive justice. Sociomuseology can be the link that enhances museology's place based on the need to promote critical thinking about contemporary world. And for us, it will be this critical thinking that will allow us to understand urban futures and historical urban landscapes as an aspect of the impoverishment of humanity in the present times. And that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mario. Thank you. That's wonderful. The way you brought in dialogical, plurilogical, if you will, from monological to interdisciplinary, and putting people in the center, which means people and the issues, contemporary issues in the center, being relevant. Wonderful, so eloquently spoken, Mario. Thank you so much. Now we move on to the last panelist. But before we move on to the last panelist, since we have a very eminent scholar and a very eminent educationalist among us, Professor Bill Koch. Bill, if you could think about it after we finish the fight with Professor Ashi Masood, if you could briefly tell us, you know, you're the world's leading expert on blended learning, inclusive pedagogy. If you could give some reflections as to where we're going in terms of blended learning, inclusive pedagogy, if you could think about it, Bill, we would really appreciate it. Very short, we don't want to take up too much of your time. Now over to Professor Ashi Masood. Professor Ashi Masood.
Thank you so much, Professor Gala, for inviting me to be part of this panel. I've really enjoyed listening to the panelists today, and I'm really glad to be here. As I participate from Anand Pashto University today in Ahmedabad, there are two thematics that I wanted to address. I think first, what does inclusion and sustainability mean in the immediate and in the long-term future? And second, what are the pathways for the future to safeguard grassroots cultural and linguistic diversity? Both of these imperatives are really coming together, as I see it, in the informal cities of the Global South. Let me situate what I am going to say in some numbers first. In 2014, 54% of the world's population was urban. By 2050, it's expected that more than 2/3 of the world's population will be urban. Three countries of the global south, that is India, China, and Nigeria, will house 35% of this projected growth. So our future is urban, and it is located largely in the global south. First, I want to argue today that this urban future is also informal. 1/8 of the world's population lives in slums, though that is by no means the only measure of urban informality. By another metric, as much as 82% of urban workers in South Asia and about 2/3 in sub-Saharan Africa are informally employed. What do we mean by the informal? I mean, we are talking about habitats, we are talking about employment, so what do we mean by the informal? This is a term that is actually endlessly contested. Very simply, we can understand it in contrast to the formal, that which is planned, regulated, tended, and supported by the state. The informal city, on the other hand, is in some ways wild. It is resistant to law and regulation. It is sometimes benignly, but sometimes also malignly neglected by the state apparatus. Close your eyes for a moment and think of Dharvi in Mumbai, think of Kalbira in Nairobi, or think of the favelas of Rio de Janeiro. Now, this informal city has typically been seen as a hotbed of urban problems. Whether you think of congestion, whether you think of poor provisioning of public services, water access or sanitation. When it comes to healthcare, it evokes high morbidity and mortality. It stands for economic and social disparity. If the formal city is a kind of a garden, then the informal city is the weed. And in fact, policymakers in many countries, in many cities around the world have responded to it by trying to weed it out. But what I want to argue today is that the informal city is the future of our urbanizing world, but more importantly, it is also the custodian of a vast repository of urban intangible and tangible heritage. This tangible heritage that I'm speaking about includes the remarkable diversity of built form in the slums of Ahmedabad or Lima or Johannesburg. It includes the skills and the crafts and the talents that are unique to this informal economy. Think about the circuits of e-waste disassembly or processing in cities like Bangalore. Think about the remarkable artisanal trades of Banaras, weavers, woodworkers, metal workers, maestries. In my own work, I have documented the legacy, for example, of community kirtan, devotional musical form that is really unique to informal communities and particularly informs the life of its female participants in working class South Delhi. The very form and aesthetic of kirtan, as Professor Motino was pointing out, it really depends on that call response dialogic logic between participants. There is a lot of work to be done in documenting and, where appropriate, supporting these knowledge systems and practices. The speakers before me have spoken about the role of social museology in preserving urban heritage. And indeed, in India, there are many private and community museums that are doing this work. For example, in Delhi, there is the Center for Community Knowledge at Ambedkar University, which celebrates neighborhood museums, even though it's not necessarily through the lens of the urban informal. This intangible heritage also encompasses the wealth of unspoken practices and tacit knowledges. You know, all of the legal and technical workarounds that we know as jugaad. And this is incidentally a Hindi word that has now entered the Oxford English Dictionary. In my own field of urban studies, a variety of scholars have investigated grassroots practices of occupancy by which claims are actually made in the informal city. Now, jugaad or occupancy are by no means really innocuous or harm-free practices. But as I have discovered in my own work on the cycle rickshaw market, informality is necessitated by a legal system that refuses to afford recognition to such livelihoods and forms of exchange. Globally, and there are a lot of definitional wrinkles here, some estimates suggest that these bazaar economies could add up to a GDP of about $10 trillion annually. And that is a really fast growing number. When it comes to the future, however, the informal city seems to be even more problematic to policymakers. So think of the narrow lanes of Dharavi and the social distancing that is required in this or future pandemics immediately becomes a nightmare. This is even more the case when it comes to climate change adaptation. what would retrofitting of energy systems in an unauthorized colony look like? The range of green building rating and certification programs so far, whether you think of LEED or the Indian Green Building Council, have had little to say about such settlements. Yet it is in the slums and in the settlements in the economy of the informal city that the sustainable development goal of cities and communities must be realized. This is an agenda that really needs to be front and center both in policy and pedagogy. I want to end today on a little bit of a hopeful note by sharing the example of work that has been done in our own Masters in Urban Design program at Anant National University. After learning about informal systems, one of our students documented the informal waste management practices in his own settlement. Another went further and designed a street landscape that made space for urban agriculture and for street vendors to participate in the busy life of a major intersection in Ahmedabad. Elsewhere at Anant University, and Anant fellows have worked closely with urban informal communities on themes as diverse as COVID-era livelihoods, as well as parental involvement in schools. Whether you think of the breadth and the sheer scale, or the depth of lived experience, the so-called shadow or informal city guards both the past heritage and the future promise of the world's cities. It demands really from all of us new forms of practice-informed research and research-informed practice for a more inclusive and sustainable future. And that's my contention. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Professor Sood. That's wonderful. I think in many ways you brought everything together from the perspective of the next generation. And I know that one of our participants is asking about Hull. Those of you who are not familiar with it, Hull is historical urban landscapes. It's a soft law instrument of UNESCO from 2011. And Joanne already mentioned about 2015 museum recommendation of UNESCO. These are two soft law instruments. And in fact, the conference, the 13th International Conference on the Inclusive Museum, is being organized in Lisbon simply because we want to look at the intersectionality, intersectionality of the two soft law instruments of UNESCO, both Hull and the museum recommendation. So, but we don't want to talk about just the instruments so that people don't think we are dealing with compliance, but we are dealing with practice, theory and practice, and that's what we are doing in this conference session. Now, before we move on to questions, I've already requested Professor Bill Cope. We are the post-pandemic Professor Cope. We will be moving into, we're already moving into a blended situation. A blended situation requires translation of our curricula in terms of training, in terms of museum education, online, but also face-to-face, and requires a different kind of more sophisticated pedagogy. Professor Bilko, with all your knowledge, could you make some reflections, please? Thank you.
Yes, I mean, one of the things this pandemic has done, exactly what you're saying there, Amar, it's actually forced us to go online with a lot of things. We haven't had any alternative to do that. And one of the questions that I'm asking is what will, exactly the question you're asking, in fact, which is what will be the lasting effects of that and what we can do. Now, one of the problems, the starting point, we've been forced to go online with tools which are really fraught. So one set of tools is Instagram and Facebook and these American-owned things, by the way. I'm in the US at the moment, but I'm an Australian citizen. Which are deeply problematic in terms of the space they give you to present something, but also the fact that they control the feed, they control, you know, you can put a post out and you've got 1,000 members in your group and 50 people see it. So their agendas are essentially advertising agendas. So one of our questions has been, vis-a-vis social media, how do you take control of social media? And what we've been building with Scholar and folks who have been part of the research network are in Scholar. It's free to open an account. It's free to use the community area in Scholar. It's building something where you own your own content. So when you put stuff on Facebook, you've actually given it to Facebook. And then they make money out of prioritizing your work in a feed, and if it's not going to make money for them for advertising and it's not relevant, you get virtually no hits. It's inscrutable. So we've built a transparent activity stream feed which is replicated on social media, but each post is not the length of a tweet or not the length of a Facebook post. Each post can be like a blog post. So everybody's welcome to use that. Common Ground's a not-for-profit. Some parts of it we need to be able to get revenue to work. So we have AI-based analytics in there as well, where we need to try and earn some money to pay people's salaries, essentially. But large parts of it are free, but it doesn't involve the manipulation of feeds, and you own the content. But also what we do is we double this platform as an e-learning platform. So what we want to do is we want this to be highly social, highly interactive. So one of the lessons of social media is that we've gone from these horizontal knowledge flows or kind of hub and spoke knowledge flows where, I read a newspaper and there's precious little connection with other people who are readers. So one of the things social media does, it builds horizontal community. Well, we want to do that in classrooms. So what we're doing is in the learning environment, we're building these horizontal communities, but also communities where people can use not just Word files to produce what they do or PDFs, but multimodal texts, which are collaboratively constructed around peer review and all that kind of stuff. Now, we model that with the Common Ground communities, but in a sense, I want to go to a second set of digital tools. So I spoke about social media. Now I'm going to speak about e-learning systems. E-learning systems are all old hub and spoke file shifting systems. Whether it's Coursera or Blackboard or any of these things, they are not collaborative spaces. They're not multimodal spaces. They're spaces where the teacher uploads a video and someone watches it. Now, they are deeply problematic as well. So what we've been working on is trying to build a next generation of e-learning environments, which is this environment called Scholar. And I work at the University of Illinois. My team has been lucky enough to get some quite large grants to build this over a number of years. And our intents are absolutely social, absolutely political, to hand the ownership of content back to content creators and allow them to be in control of those feeds. Now, what we do is we post everything in Facebook, but there's always a link back to Scholar. Right, which is we want the real action to happen in a place where we control. We're happy to make things as visible as Facebook and Instagram and whatever and Twitter allow us to make them, which is not very, in fact, but bring people back into a space where we're in control. So that's a quick introduction to what we're doing. What I'm going to do is, if people are interested, I am going to paste into the chat box a link which is a description of Scholar from an e-learning point of view. I'm also going to put a link in there. We have a blog where we keep talking about this stuff as well. That's the second link. And in a moment, I'll put in a third link, which is we have in Common Ground, something we call the Common Ground Media Lab, where we're trying to innovate and build these next generation of we call these social knowledge technologies, not social media, social knowledge, where people are collaboratively working with each other to build academic knowledge, cultural heritage, whatever. So that's a quick intro. Thank you, Amar. I wasn't expecting you to invite me to do that.
That's great. And all of you who are listening, and this is being recorded, so it'll be shared widely beyond this session, is that the blog that Professor Bill Cope talked about, I'm a regular reader. I read everything that's posted on that blog because I find that it's way ahead of some of the discussion that's taking place online. And it's the most educational tool that I have, I look forward to every time there's a post. Professor Cope, I really appreciate it. But I have one question before we have a small number of questions. I have one question for you. You mentioned about horizontal, the spread, but we in museums and we in history circles, we're dealing with architecture, heritage, design. One malady we all suffer from is cultural amnesia. So how do you build depth, horizontal, but how do you go deep, in the
right. So the word that I use is a kind of an architectural word, Murray, you might like this, which is the word scaffolds. So what we do is we build these scaffolds where we might, let's say in a museum context, we might post something which is an artifact in the museum and get people to talk about it. But what we might also do is ask people, well, you put something in this virtual museum yourself. You find an example of something which is in your life, in your community, in your experience. And yes, we'll be lightweight curators of this object, but you post the object. So what we have in the posting area in Scholar is the ability to write around the video, to put in media objects of all kinds. So, but we're expecting these will be kind of substantial things. So the idea behind this, if it's a learning environment, it's the co-design of the curriculum. If it's a museum, it's the co-design of the museum. So we will not just post our, the stuff that we're delivering to you as curators, we will get you to contribute items to this museum as well. And by the way, we can, anything inappropriate, we can remove it, we can edit it, we can modify it, we can ask you to modify it, but then it builds a kind of a horizontal dialogical relationship. So what we're on about is whether it's learning or whether it's these other cultural spaces, we're on about building these dialogical communities, not monological transmission. We're transmitting culture to you, but dialogical, well, yes, we will transmit things to you, but you're also able to contribute and translate things back. And so the key word we use both for education and other social sites is co-design. So what we do is we're going to enlist you as co-designers in this space, not just as passive recipients of what happens in the space, but we're going to actually entrust you to be co-designers. And if you break that trust, we'll edit it, we'll delete it, we'll do something. But nevertheless, we're going to start from a moment of trust.
Thank you, Professor Cope. One reflection, you use the word co-design. One of the most popular things right now in Europe, in fact, it's very sexy, everybody likes to say it, is co-design, co-curate, co-create. These are the three terms that they're using all the time. But the kind of criticism that's coming is people are still doing the same thing, but there's still that us and them binary, very much, something that modernity created that Uta was talking about. Is it possible, as we move towards meeting in Brisbane next year, that we explore this, co-design, co-create, co-curate, doing a survey with our participants who are registered, or future will be registering, and create an online forum, just before the conference in Lisbon next year, and also throughout the conference engage people with the notion of co-create, co-design, co-curate. Is it possible?
Yeah, of course. Let's do it. Okay, and also, by the way, the Common Ground tools, I'm not sure whether all 121 have accounts. You can create an account for free. And what I spoke about is available at no charge. And you can build communities yourself within that space. Mm-hmm. So we have to give a sense of the scale of it, we have about 250,000 accounts in there at the moment. And our aim is to be not Facebook, not Instagram, not Twitter, better in all of those, without the advertising, without the manipulation, without the control by somebody else. So that's what our philosophy is. So anybody, please go and form an account. The links I sent you there, the link into the learning new learning community, you can see it. It's visible. But if you'd like to join it, go and create an account and join us.
Thank you, Professor Cope. That's really encouraging, because an issue that comes up in museums is the ethics of engagement. The kind of transparency you talked about is going to be highly respected. And I think that we all look forward to next year in Lisbon, how we can collaborate, it's about what you used to talk about when we were all in Australia, collaborative learning and teaching, right?
By the way, it's also about diversity. It's about every possible voice being there. And one of the arguments is, look, I've got a little formula, a social science formula, which is as soon as you leave space for agency, diversity appears, right? Right. So in other words, if you give people agency, the people coming to the virtual, the real museum, the minute you give them agency, there's this incredibly rich diversity, right? That without agency, the diversity is not visible. It's what I call an architecture of sameness, right? But the minute you actually hand over some agency, you have diversity. It's inevitable.
Yeah. Thanks, Professor Cope. Agency. That's what Joanna was talking about, is the diversity that she's dealing with, how she's trying to engage with. And one of the things in Europe, again, is once agency is given, once it's plurilogical, you know, from monological to dialogical to plurilogical, the whole question of atmosphere, I'm not talking about ambience, but atmosphere, theories of atmosphere are being debated. How do we all collaboratively create the atmosphere in that experiential space, both in the museums and the outreach in reach of the museums? How do we do that? So let's follow up this. We'll follow up this very targeted. We'll do a survey with all our participants and build it up towards Lisbon next year. Those of you listening, if you're not registered for the International Conference on the Inclusive Museum, just on museums, plural, on museums.com or .org, you'll go there. You'll go to the site. It's as simple as that. Bill, if you could post it in the chat box. Now, coming to the questions, I'll go from the bottom because somebody wants to know more about sociomuseology. My strong recommendation is that it's such an exciting and amazing area. Just Google sociomuseology, or just Google Professor Mario's name, or Google my name, and you'll get a lot of sociomuseology stuff, publications dealing with under the title of eco museums. Okay, so please do that, all of you, you know, and whoever asks the question. Now here is one from a young person. So I hope all the panelists are listening. As we are talking about the history of our urban landscape, but as in we see that in today's generation, the history about design and architecture is lost. So how can we as students and part of today's generation, and we be going to be the future of the of our world, make a change about this thinking? So Uta, I'm going to look at you, you know, sort of to answer this question to kickstart. Could you want me to read it again, Uta?
I have to unmute. Yeah, thank you. I was already reading this question in the chat, and I'm not sure if there is just one answer, but probably multiple answers. So first of all, let me question the note that, or not question, but maybe discuss. It would be interesting if the one who asked the question may answer again in the chat so that we'll get a feedback. I would very much appreciate. So if I understand correctly, the notion is to say that the young generation has lost the knowledge on the history of design and architecture, which I may doubt. I mean, I guess many are, you experience it everywhere. So it's something that is not just something that is educated in universities to architects, but that is something that everybody can experience. And what we just heard, I was quite impressed of what Bill was telling about the Common Grounds platform. Knowledge is available everywhere, so it is rather that we have to learn to observe and to go in it. And coming back maybe to what speaking about Docomomo, it was exactly that. At that time when it was founded, my colleague Wessel was a young student, and they started to see these abandoned buildings, and they started to question themselves, what is it about, why they are there, why are they abandoned? So I think it's a training, of course, of all of us to be aware and to observe and to question ourselves, which may already be a part of the answer to the question, what can we do with the young generation? So Amar, you just gave so many links of where knowledge is available about eco-museums and socio-museology. And even if we are critical as scientists about open source platforms, but nevertheless, I mean, online you can find so much information that you can, where you can research, which even talking about agency that Bill was addressing, which even you may influence with your knowledge and with real information about the place, not just with reading books, but by going to the place and add information to the knowledge of the world. I just want also to mention an example of the And Joanna was also mentioning in that people can bring in their own knowledge. Yeah, they create part of the knowledge that is then afterwards co-designed, co-curated, and co-created in the and exposed or exhibited in the museums. But there is also the example of the Berlin Architectural Museum, which is linked to the TU Berlin in Germany. And what they, for example, also do is they have, of course, an abundance of material from regions which were Germany in the past and which are now part of Poland or White Russia or the Baltic countries. But they have an open access database, so people from those countries can access the database, and they can even reposition buildings so that they say, no, listen, this information in the database is wrong. In fact, the building is in that place. So there is already a kind of communication and dialogue. So my answer would be active and try to use and profit from the tools and means that are already available.
Thanks, Uta. That's wonderful. Anyone else on the panel who would like to make a short intervention? You have to unmute yourself if you want to say something. Well, if not, then we go to another question. I think this is at the young Professor Ashim Masood. Explain again about the formal and the informal city. That's the question. Can you be very brief, Ashima?
Yes, absolutely. Now, thank you for that question. You know, I'm trying to think about a visual representation of, what we are talking about, what I mean by the formal and the informal. So one, analogy that I gave is that the formal city is the intended city. It's the planned city. It has the support of the state in many ways. On the other hand, if you think of the informal city, then it's the unintended city. It's the city that was not part of the plan. I like the analogy of the garden. Right. And of course, the garden city has been a really important paradigm in a lot of cities around the world. And then you have the weed, right? And that is, in fact, what the informal city is. I do wanted to give you a little bit of a visual, suggestion. You know, how do you see this? There is actually a beautiful digital exhibition called Landscape of Surprise. This is actually, a study, a documentation of the making of Cyberabad in Hyderabad. And it was done by the German urbanist called Peter Gotch. And I recommend, I wish I had the opportunity here to show you some of these images. But, you go and look at some of those images, and I think you will immediately understand.
Could you post it in the chat box, the link?
I will definitely do that. I will do that. Yeah. Thank you again for that question.
Yeah. And then another question that comes about, that's asked, is how urbanism shapes the history of a particular area. Once again, there's so much online. If you go onto search engines and look for placemaking, you would get considerable amount of material on this. It's a wonderful question, but there's a lot in the public domain that you'll be able to access. And then, of course, then there's the question, whether urbanism fulfills all the demands of the local people of the area very well, and then why the urban center is sometimes treated as the backdrop of urbanism. It's kind of a double-edged question, so why are the urban centers, becoming the backdrop of the process of urbanism? Who wants to answer this? Hello, Uta, did it come to you?
I guess there might be multiple reasons for that. And maybe let me again do a kind of a comparison with 100 years before, like the beginning of modern movement, as not just to promote Docomomo. I will put the link also in the chat box later. Actually, the Indian chapter of Docomomo was only founded in 2018. And so I really would like to, because I saw there are many people from India in the webinar. So we are still looking for members, and we need young people who look for and document and observe these kind of processes. And maybe that is also one of the answers to your question, why are the centers so kind of neglected? Of course, it is mainly, I would say, a kind of political decision. It is about increasing land prices. It's about a pressure that city centers have become very expensive all over the world, with different maybe levels of and amount of money, which means that many practices, that many crafts, that many people had to leave the centers, and only, let's say, global companies or luxurious housing is able. And we see this tendency everywhere. It might be, and that is a critique also to modernity. It doesn't mean that being a member of Docomomu means that everything is just positive, but it is an observation that, of course, modernity, and in particular the post-World War II, so after 1950, modernity was mainly petroleum and car driven. So infrastructure actually led to a kind of separation of the functions, you know? I mean, people were working in one part and sleeping in another part of the city. And I think nowadays we are coming back to this idea of a more multifunctional city, of combining again living and working and the leisure spaces, we are inclusive also in that sense, that we are looking back on how city were before motorization, individual mobility, and I guess that was another reason of why the big shopping malls went outside, the residential areas went outside, the universities went outside the cities, and now we are trying to get them all back. Yeah, I think this is a challenge. This is one part of the answer. Maybe there are more answers from the comments.
Thanks, Uta. Much appreciated. The question next one is to you, Joanna. Can museums support counter-narratives of itself? Counter-narratives as narratives that appear alongside or outside the museum's primary or dominant narrative. Joanna?
Yes, it's a very good question. So thank you for the question. And yes, absolutely, the museums can support counter-narratives of themselves, and should do it, and are doing it more and more. They are coming up from grassroots research, from the practice field, and also from the academy, of course. Some topics like the decolonization and slavery being on the top of the museum's narrative and not just on the backstage, or even, which is a lot worse, just invisible. And so we are, many of us, doing some studies and some work about it. In our case, in the Museum of Lisbon, the City of Lisbon, 3 years ago, we started, along with other museums in our country, in our city specifically, a project with scholars and museum professionals about pointing out and studying testimonies on slavery, specific cases of slaves, and what we as colonial countries did exactly with figures and with human stories without escape. Yes, Amar.
No, sorry.
We start that, but we didn't stop there. We are going through on that path. And we had 2 years ago, actually it was 1 year and a half, a temporary exhibition that was called Plural Lisbon, about different communities that are living in the same city with different religions and different geographical backgrounds since the Middle Age, and how they kept until the 19th century. We will go again on that topic to address the contemporary ages, but about how they lived together in peace and in war. So addressing both issues.
Could you Could you paste a link to that exhibition
in the
chat box?
Of course.
And also to your museum, because we're all coming to your museum.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Sorry. May I also, Amar, if you agree, pass the link to CAMOC website, because
Monica
is asking here how can she or he get in touch with ICOM community and learn more about city museums?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. I'll do that.
And there is a question about intangible. I'll come to that. But first is a question on how can museums serve layers of the age group, knowledge, and socioeconomic development categories? Mario, is sociomuseology. I mean, this is what you do. So would you like to answer that, Mario?
Maybe I can have some idea about. I think with Joan that museum can, produce counter-narrative and propose different looks, different ways of understanding the things. But I think that the main question is how can museums support to create a critical think in each person, a self-critical thinking? This is the question, because if we go on in trying to support people to demystify what's coming every day, through newspapers, through television, through schools, universities, through all these things, and to try to understand for themselves what's going on, then we can understand the other things. And we don't need that someone gives us a counter-narrative. People will make their own counter-narrative, and they'll be able to understand what is going on. I think we go back to Paulo Freire every time. There are no other way. We must go back there and see that everybody has his own knowledge, and that's in the dialogue that these things can come. And what is the place of the museums that to make possible that people talk each one to other, and not only to stay in the position of which is a kind of colonial thought, just to hit what the others produced. I can understand those questions about co-creation and cook something. It's okay. But in the point, that's how museums can support this and bring people to think by their own selves.
Thanks, Mario. Mario, next year is the 100th birth anniversary of Paulo Freire next year. So when we meet in Lisbon, as part of the conference, would you be able to propose and organize a session on Paulo Freire, the centenary of Paulo Freire and the thinking thought process, which you just so beautifully articulated? I'll get back to you on this, because within the time I got one more question that I can't.
We can work on that idea.
Fantastic.
Well, that's good. We'll be very nice. Very good.
Thank you. Okay, there's a question here, and I'd like to read it out because I love this question. I would like to underline that beyond the architecture and the urban landscape, as you mentioned, that we should learn again to look and observe at things, but what about the information that is no longer visible? A landscape even in the countryside hosts culture and heritage. As an architect, I believe that we focus only on built and tangible heritage, but what about intangible that are mute and to be rediscovered, part where the museum can help to disclose to the public? It's a wonderful question. Joanna and I are passionate, and so is all the panelists, in fact, passionate about, you know, revitalization of the multiple layers of heritage, both intangible and tangible, within urban landscapes, whatever you want to call it. But whoever asked this question, because I can't tell, is very important, because today was our orientation. So I was addressing about 200 design and architecture students. My message to them was, please don't think of the design finished product. It's not about an object. Please don't think about the building. Don't have an edifice complex. Think of the process. Design is about thinking. And if you lose the thinking, But when you think of thinking as the main goal, then you receive the past, you build on it based on the contemporary challenges, limitations, and possibilities, and you look forward to the future to make sure that design is to improve life. So also architecture is to improve life. In India, architecture during the pandemic is a total disaster. It is a total disaster because all the places where people live are built based on measurements, based on how much space for each bedroom. The idea of a space where people could get outside, you know, is a little garden, a little gym exercise area, which doesn't work in the pandemic situation because of the physical distancing. And so people have not been consulted in designing the architecture and the design of places in India. And I'm not sure other countries are doing any better. Although I lived for 4.5 years in Denmark, I think the Danes got it right in some ways, because they, for them, design is about improving life. So that's a wonderful question. And the question of intangible is critical to understand our sense of place and identity and what the spaces that we create. What's the difference between sociomuseology and ecomuseology? Mario, I'll leave it to you because we both are not much, right? Not much difference. At the end of the day,
Very quickly, I think there are lots of ways of doing museology concerned with the issues of society. Ecomuseology is one of these ways, like native museology or critical museology or so. That's all different places, different periods give different answers to the way people are doing museology. What we are trying to do with sociomuseology is to find inside social science a link between all these things so that we can understand it, that those productions, we can say, in a holistic way. And this not just because we would like to know everything about, but that's because maybe you can produce new tools and new reflections so that go back to the field and improve again eco-museums, local museums, neighborhood museums, and all these things. So that's a little bit different. We try to find the rationality of all these processes that are all over the world, and now finally are recognized with some institution like UNESCO. So we believe that is the right way. And we must think every time that museology is not different of the other social sciences. All the other public social science, it's okay. Sociomuseology is like all the other social science.
Fantastic, Mario, beautiful, very eloquently explained. I just want to add that whoever asked the question, having worked on 4 eco museums in 4 different countries in my lifetime, the simple thing is eco museology is a methodology to bring people and their heritage together. It's as simple as that. It's not an edifice, it's not site centered, but it's a process. It's a methodology to bring people and their heritage together. And so, I think we're almost out of time. We're out of time, but the last question is for Joanna. Joanna, the question is, in many ways, what is called cultural quarters, museums play a vital role. Do you think establishing such quarters could benefit the city and the museum also? Joanna, I'm thinking about Fado, you know, the whole neighborhood of Fado Museum. And Fado is intangible heritage on the UNESCO representative list, but it's also Fado Museum is a collection. Would you like to answer this? Because Fado is a cultural quarter, which connects Lisbon with the rest of the world, but also with its own people.
Yes, it got to be a cultural quarter, but I'd like to go back to the question and answer, sure. It depends. Because it can benefit the city and the museum also, or it cannot benefit. I would say it depends a lot on whether it's grassroots or not, whether it's artificially done for tourism goals or not. Because if it concerns real culture, grassroots practices, like in the Father Kotje you like and you miss, I can tell. You'll be there next year, hopefully. It's of course very, very good because it's like a hub of knowledge, of sensitivity, and of culture being reactivated, reinterpreted, and created as new also. And that benefits the development of that quartier and the city as a whole, or at least the neighborhood, and also benefits the museum, which is about that theme, which is the case of the Father Museum, of course. And the museum also enhances the cultural life of the quartier itself. So it's a win-win connection, a win-win relation when this can happen. But if a cultural quartier is created only to concentrate consumers and tourists, it can be very effective for the consumers or the shops or both, but it does not necessarily mean that there is a lot of relevant knowledge or a relevant new cultural life coming from it.
Thank you, Joanna, that's fantastic. I think that's something we all need to hear, because tourism being, you know, the major industry in the world, it's driving the so-called cultural quarters. In India too, I've come across, you know, people using adaptive reuse and leading to gentrification of so-called cultural quarters in the context of tourism. And I think what you just raised there is something we have to think very critically. We're all looking forward to coming and visiting Lisbon next year and offer a fantastic inclusive museum, international conference on the inclusive museum. For all of you listening, this is a research network and we're meeting in Lisbon next year in the second week of September. You'll find it on the link that's been sent to you. And we all welcome you, and we'll also keep in touch with you through this network. Our Common Ground Research Network has got all your contacts. You'll be hearing more about the conference. But in closing, I would really like to ask Professor Bill Cope to say a few words. Bill, over to you.
Thank you very much, Amar. And look, thank you everyone for being here. This is not just a great conversation that we've had, but also a great resource. You know, one of the accidental consequences of us moving into this virtual world is we can instantly record something. You know, we can just record it along the way. So thank you not only to the people who are here in our virtual room today, but the people who are going to be in expanding time as well as space, because this recording will last, and the, you know, wherever it is, talk back to us and the conversation continues. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you, Professor Bill Cope. Thank you, everyone. And please look at the links. Try to go onto the webpage on museums.com. You can sign up for the newsletter, it's free. There are a lot of free resources over there. So just your, you know, right now you don't have, you might find it daunting to think about next year when you're still in the pandemic, but there's nothing wrong in the digital domain, which you have such wonderful access to look at, you know, what is possible next year, you know, sort of. Thank you, everybody. Wonderful. Take care. Be safe wherever you are. Ciao. Adios. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
And when you exit, there'll be a, I gather there'll be an evaluation form set that comes to you automatically. All right.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Thanks, Mario. Thanks, Joanna. Bye. Thanks, Ashima. Thanks, Uta, you've been wonderful. And Bill, Professor Bill Cope. And thank you, everybody. And also Sharvari and Vishal Bhai behind the scenes making it all happen. I'm so grateful to you. Bye for now.
Thank you.